Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held at London's Olympia. This episode is all about trends in flavour and colour. Our expert panel unpacks why flavour is still king and why the days of designing something that appeals to everybody are effectively over.
We are joined today by these impeccably knowledgeable thought leaders shaping the future of food. No pressure. Through adding and enhancing the sensory attributes of food, we're able to keep pace with accelerating consumer demands and the trends that shape the industry. More than the newest flavor of beef-free bubblegum, today we will discuss the key broad trends in flavor, color, and innovation. Today we are joined by Regina, Ross, Alexandra, Michael, and Robert. Would you guys like to go 1 through 5, state your name again, and tell us kind of what you do and who you work for?
Hi everyone, I'm Alexandra Kulik. I'm product experience researcher at IFF. So I work for Flavor House and I look after culinary category from the perspective of sensory and consumer insights.
I'm Regina Massivichute-Hayden. I'm from Mintel and I'm a food and drink analyst with a focus on flavors.
Hi, I'm Russell Hayward. I work for the bakery food giant that is Finsbury Food. And I work at the front end of innovation and run all the newness that goes with business.
Good morning. I'm Robert Craggs. I am the global senior development chef for Pladis, and I sit in the front end innovation team and I lead all things culinary.
And I'm Mike Turner. So I work for PepsiCo in the snack side of the business. I look after all our flavors within the UK, or my team does, and our portfolio transformation across Europe.
Also, a quick introduction to myself. I'm a flavor and innovation technology consultant. I do cool stuff with flavor and cool stuff with digital things. So today we're going to ask a few different questions, and it's going to be ranging kind of in discussion. Now, whenever we think of innovation, I always start with data. And some people say, always start with Mintel. Regina, thinking of the broad value proposition expected by consumers, what is the weight of tangential attributes like health and wellness, and how do these stack up against the increased pressure on people's income?
Well, that's a very good question. Thank you, Trevor. But I'll probably start by stating an obvious: flavor is king. Whatever we do, if the product doesn't taste good, no one's going to like it or buy it. Perhaps I should start with kind of cost of living side of the question. When people are facing tough economic times, and a lot do now and did in the past, they become obviously very careful with where they spend their money on. And very often they would go and choose something that they've known for a very long time rather than something groundbreakingly new, because they might get disappointed and they will feel that they are losing their money. Equally, consumers do want to have fun. They want to have indulgent moments. They want to taste something good. So in these instances, flavor kind of brings extra value to them, makes products that they buy as a treat, as a moment of indulgence, as a moment of treating themselves to something that perhaps they wouldn't do otherwise. But those innovations, they need to be relevant. They need to taste good, as I said, because if they don't, that will automatically defer consumers from trying again, from recommending to other consumers. The other part of the question was health and wellness. And some may think that health and wellness, flavor and indulgence is two different planets. They are not. They are very much interconnected. And actually, flavors can help healthy products, healthy foods to taste good, to feel as if you are treating yourself. And also, considering that, well, the pace of life is very quick. And consumers increasingly have very complex health and well-being goals. And they want to achieve them in a very flavorsome way, in a very quick way. So that's why there is a lot of pressure on food and drink industry to bring healthy, functional, better for you products that equally taste good. And also that also creates this emotional connection and emotional engagement with brands, which then creates much better loyalty and kind of encourages repurchase instances. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Amazing. I think it's thought provoking when we start to think about how we can use product design to kind of create joy or to bring kind of happiness to a consumer. And we need to really think about how is this going to land, you know, in the consumption moment when people are purchasing something for the first time. What is that consumption moment and how can we measure the weight of our lever, right? Before we launch a product, how do we actually make sure that it's going to land well with the consumer base? It's going to be novel enough, but not too novel that it kind of drives uncanny valley. It can't be weird, right? It needs to be something that people are expecting that drives that repeat purchase. And based on kind of what you were talking about, Regina, Alexandra, I wonder if you can kind of expand on that more, but tell us specifically what the role of social media is in predicting these kind of trends before they arise and how flavor and color are used to affect feelings and emotion within a consumer base.
Yes, that's a really good question. And I really like to tap in and bounce back to that statement that you said that consumers will not compromise on taste. Whatever lifestyle trend they are in, whatever drives them in life, they want joyful type of products. So joy, I read some interesting research recently that the joy is one of the highest predictor of the repurchase of the product. So I'm just thinking like consumers are really increasingly searching for the food that will bring them joy, bring them emotional connection on top of that functional, nutritional values. Right, so this is what we do at IFF. So as a flavor house, we try to guide the design of the flavors that could really trigger specific emotions and feelings in the consumers. So we've got in-house like a mood management program, which is a global program. And over there, we focus a lot on understanding the need states of the consumers. Of specific products from salty snacks to beverages, CSD drinks, or table sauces even. And try to really understand, firstly, what are the need states? Are we talking about the energy boost? Are we talking about the relaxation? And try to decode the features of the product that could bring this and fulfill this need. So talking about the flavor as such, we build a robust database around the flavors that are appealing, firstly, but also the flavors that are associated with the consumers with certain feelings. And we can see many differences between the different generations, different markets. Very interesting research. Like, for instance, like giving you the example of the what, how that uplifted mood or bliss feelings could be evoked in a British consumers of CSD drinks from the perspective of the color, our research shown that all the warm kind of colors like orange, golden, yellow, that triggers that energy, but also happiness in the consumers. If you add glitter to it, even more. But in terms of the flavor directions, what could bring that bliss? We confirmed that for CSD users in UK, all the citrus directions are associated highly with happiness and bliss, in addition to tropical, mango, etc. On contrary, just to give you another example on relaxation, for instance, if you would like to design the product, the CSD drink that could be relevant for relaxation territory, British consumers say that white peach could be a good direct flavor direction to go, or lemongrass was mentioned. In terms of the colors, they would be more looking to the paler palette of the colors or white, bluish kind of direction. So we've got lots of insights around that. Very interesting. But so all that insights are there for our design teams to actually guide the direction. Like it depends on what type of brief we get from the customers. We try to answer it, making it relevant and consumer-centric.
Well, I think that's amazing. Like, I know as a flavorist, I would maybe target my design based on a particular end product, but actually targeting design to a particular emotion, I think is super important. And it's something that's kind of novel, right? In terms of the trends specifically in how we innovate, innovating in order to target a specific emotion or feeling within a consumer base, I think that's a novel approach. I wonder how, I mean, I know it's going to be difficult, but how do you measure the effect? So once you release something and launch it onto the market, it's going to be really difficult to then go back to consumers and say, you tried this, by the way, CSD carbonated soft drink. How happy do you feel now?
Yes, so very good one, because like, so we do lots of research around that emotional territory. One is explicit, so it's about what the consumer tell us, like via online survey, via some test, but we also measure it in implicit ways. So we use neuroscience, for instance, to understand the body reaction and the brain reaction to the flavor, which is very interesting to see actually that if the flavor works the way we want it, the way we design it, like does it really trigger that energize part of the brain, or and actually is it like or not? Because sometimes, you know, consumers tell you one thing, yes, I like it, but the body reaction and the brain reaction tells us something totally opposite. So it's kind of the validation that we have in-house.
Yeah, yeah, cool. I think it's really good, because the whole point is like, everything is try before you buy, right? So what we're trying to do as designers is we're all trying to put something out on the market that we hope is the next thing since sliced bread, right? We want it to be amazing, but you don't know how a consumer is going to take that, because we don't, as I always used to say, I don't make flavors for flavorists. I make flavors for consumers. So in a way, me judging something to being good or bad is irrelevant. It's how is it going to land within a consumer base? So all of these different pieces of information that can give us an insight into how it's going to land enables us to validate what that return on investment is going to be, what the full cost benefit analysis based on all of these kind of multi-sensory cues. We're going to change tack slightly, but still sticking on the main theme. And I'm going to ask Michael, how do you see generational shifts changing the speed at which trends are emerging? So if we think about like, how do you know whether to stay put and kind of innovate within your known remit or push out and be risky?
Yeah, so a lot of what we do within PepsiCo, we see a lot of changes in generations. So I think the days are gone of where you make something that's happy for everybody. As we start shifting more and more into a world, but there's some really good data around Gen Zs that even within that great group of people, there's fragments within there, and they all link to a moment or an occasion. I think we just spoke about occasions and moments that they're in. There's factions breaking out within each layer. We used to make products or core products that would be happy for everybody. Everyone eat them, and they're culturally relevant into where they are. So let's take Walker's Cheese and Onion for an example. Walker's Cheese and Onion is a staple in everyone's diet that everybody has eaten for years and years in their lunchboxes, and has been given to kids as we go through from parent to child, from grandparent to child. That style doesn't really exist anymore in the world that we're moving into. And how we innovate into that is how we are looking to move the category into the future. Because if we try and appease everybody, I think there's a really good saying around that, you appease everyone, you make no one happy. And so if we're really trying to drive down to what consumers want, and we talk about what we get from our flavor houses insights or insights from Mintel, you'll see over and over that people are moving into areas which are definitely more interesting for them or more personal to them. And how do we customize and make that space work? So what does that mean? So it means that there's new white spaces that we can go move into. It means that do we go with the old, and what does that mean? And the more and more we then look into the consumer data around what moments people are eating in, what occasions they're in, how that works, or even what's culturally relevant to them. And we'll have a conversation about it in a minute, I think, but around social media and how that really feeds into how flavors are changing. Culture happens so fast now that it's how do we as big FMCGs or snacks industries or industries or wherever we are move at that speed. And one of the key things is, what's a real true trend that we can stick on, and what stays around that we can jump on the back of and make great flavors for? And what is something that we can just jump in on, get some excitement through, start driving that through? I think one we're seeing at the moment, and we talk about mega trends or trends, is definitely that, like, swalty, we call it, or sweet and savory. There's lots of different ways of talking about it. But even within, like, the snacks world, which is typically salty, we're starting to see a shift towards, well, especially around generation like Gen Z, and even going into Gen Alpha, is that real balance of savory doesn't always have to be really savory. And it's really about, are we using our brands in the right way with the right flavors for the right occasions to deliver the best, most exciting moment for them? I'm just going to also touch on, when you said flavor is king, it's one of my favorite phrases that I use within Pepsi whenever I talk about it, being in the flavor team, is, as soon as we talk about anything else, if it doesn't taste good, then it kind of defeats the objective of what we're trying to do. So especially in our, like, BFY brands in there, like, taste is king on there. And so we definitely see that shift, that the one thing that really sticks amongst all of that is, does it taste good? And if the answer is yes, then that's the starting point of how we make everything else work. But yeah, we definitely have to start looking differently about how we work towards each consumer group as being a key. Who is your target audience?
You touched on so many great things, and it's really good to kind of link it all up. I think from what you were talking about now, it's like, we all trying to, I think, the renewed focus in really targeting our focus, right? So we have this focus target on where we want something to land, where we want to deliver, who is our target market. And it's really important for us to think about what our target market is in order to then measure, is that successful, yes or no? Obviously, we want everyone to be able to have everything, right? We want to be the new Coca-Cola, other brands are available, right? But it's difficult to measure in advance of that. And you're always, I think, struggling against uncanny valley, right? So this idea that when something becomes too out of the ordinary, people start to dislike it. So it's close, but not, you're trying to merge in kind of incremental steps, right? Move away from where you were.
Yeah, I'll add on it. It's a risk, right? So moving into new parts of the category is a risk. And as we see it as a business as well, it's where we try and target, is what can we do that we can maintain a core? So let's talk about Walkers or Doritos, that you have a core range. But how do you start moving towards those trends? It's always taking that risk on. And I think the best way to do it is, we look at it as a portfolio play. You know, people will throw new flavors out all the time. Most companies do it. There's different LTOs that people do. How do you be more tactical about what you do in that space? And how do we drive a category forward? And a lot of the time, it's taking risks into those spaces. Sometimes they are risks. Like, you would have seen what PepsiCo and Walkers have done this year on a few of the, like, hot honey was one we were discussing this about before, or gingerbread Doritos. They were things that we wouldn't have done 5 years ago. But with the shift in consumers and what we're seeing, we're really seeing that, you know, gingerbread Doritos was one of the biggest viral moments in the snacks thing last Christmas. And it started a real Marmite moment where people loved it or hated it. And what I really enjoyed about it was, people who were very open-minded to it, and usually was more Gen Z and under, were keen for it. And it was really funny seeing, like, the parents' reactions to it, or the boomers' reaction to it, be like, what are you doing to my Doritos? And that's the kind of plays that we're going into. But you have to take those risks, especially with where you're able to, with especially with LTOs, and see how they grow. And then once you start moving people into that category and that space, you can then start launching more into it when you see it's successful. So that's how we start moving that category forward and moving flavors forward into a space that people aren't expecting. You know, and again, it's just exciting. We see exciting things, and how do you come through? It's just a balance of what's core and what's then exciting.
I feel like what would to add something from current generational slang, we're trying to make it not all sixes and sevens, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, definitely.
some people have kids, I see. expanding on kind of what you started out with in terms of, like, focusing on something, I'm guessing a lot of people in the audience are innovators themselves, working in NBD labs. And, well, it's good that you got the day off, right? Because everyone's under the cosh, everyone's under pressure. And It seems like the pressure that innovators and NPD labs are under today is far more than it's ever been before. And sometimes those signals are coming for new trends or try this. We need to try before we buy. We have to build new things. Ross, can you tell me specifically how social media influences these rapid trends and the rapid onset of these trends? And how do we kind of meet the increased demand from consumers?
I think it's really interesting because if we look historically the way flavors work their way through from kind of kitchen all the way through to retail, it used to take a long time. I always use the example of salted caramel, kind of started in the 70s as a hook, and then it was kind of dismissed by the food people. It took forever to become culturally relevant, and now it's kind of one of the things that you are almost an expectation. And I think the algorithmic speed in which consumers are now devouring flavor and color, I think is a real testament to how different generations are consuming. I think people are almost tasting food before they even get to the shelves. They have an opinion about what they think that might taste like. You know, there would have been a time when people would have only dreamed of what those flavor trends that were coming from, I don't know, say Korea or Japan or Indonesia, there would have been just a photograph in a, excuse my age, from the 1900s, from like a holiday catalog, which a brochure that they would have looked through and they've gone, oh, that's an interesting looking piece of fruit. Whereas now it's on the shelves, it's there, they see it through. Through their social media feeds, and I also think from my place, which is in bakery, you know, we're there for every single moment of your day. We're there at breakfast, we're there at lunch, we're there for dinner, or in my world at tea time, but you know, within my celebration cake category, you know, we're there for your birthdays, your christenings, all them things. So we kind of make or break. And I know we're going to talk probably a lot about how the difference between a trend that exists and one that works for everybody and something which is really bold and new, especially with the celebration cake. It's really interesting that kind of chocolate and vanilla still remain really king because people don't want to take risks for a high value product. You know, they might be willing to risk something on a £2 pack of Doritos, but they're not going to risk it on a 20 quid birthday cake for grandma, you know, because they know Barbara doesn't like coffee. She doesn't like anything too bitter. She's never going to try a new jam. So people are less willing to experiment. But I think the younger generation have a much more aesthetic approach to flavor. They like things to taste how they view. I mean, if you spoke to my mum, she would probably tell you that she would never eat blue food. My grandma never ate pasta in her life. But whereas the generations now are looking for almost like that cerebral connection between what they taste, what they see. You know, one of my main things at the moment that I'm really looking and I'm interested in is what does texture taste like? So what does crunch actually taste like? Is it a flavor or is it just the sensory? All those things kind of merging into one create that moment, and that moment of joy, that moment of experience, that moment of culture, you know, which, you know, we're all part of, whether it be one culture, multiple cultures, you know, we're all looking for those moments. And, you know, that's where I think nostalgia comes in. Mm. And, you know, all these words have been spoken about endlessly. You know, you all hear about comfort, we hear nostalgia, we all hear about nostalgia, all these things which are floating around. But what does it actually really mean? You know, people keep asking me all the time, what's the next big flavor? What's the new Dubai chocolate, Ross? What is the new? And actually, for me, it's not about what is the new revolutionary flavor, it's what's the evolutionary flavor. So what can we do that's different with the things that people know, so they're not necessarily going to be They're not going to be overly stimulated by that, but they are still going to be excited. You know, flavor is the future, and it is what is king. People don't buy into things that people, or we can't make things that people will buy again. They've got to enjoy it. It's got to bring joy, and it's got to bring something different.
Well, I hope you realize how much power you really have, right? So I think famous people once said, give the people cake, but you make or break a cake. Oh, so you could single-handedly ruin grandma's birthday. That's a big deal, right?
And there are many people's days I have broken.
I feel like a spicy something chicken teriyaki birthday cake maybe is a step too far. Well, maybe not.
I have coined the phrase swoomami.
Love.
And I am owning that one, just so.
Okay, swoomami apparently has got the panelists raising their hands. And I think we've struck a nerve. I think the first follow-on is from Regina.
Yeah, just to add... Just to build on this, and also kind of relates to the question about costs, you know, when people strap for money, what do they do? And you mentioned that, yes, there are people that will always go for classic flavors, vanilla, chocolates, salted caramel, etc. And also very often these basic core flavors are becoming like a vehicle to bring something.
Totally.
Something new. Uber is trending everywhere. What Starbucks done, they mixed it with vanilla to kind of make it more accessible to wider audiences rather than just throwing that onto just Gen Z or just super progressive consumers. So,
and I think
but classic flavors will always, right?
And I think matcha is the big one that we're all kind of talking about these days, because matcha is... It's not a flavor. I mean, it is, obviously, it's tea. But it's what it delivers as far as being a vehicle for flavor. You know, that if you look all the way through for, if you were to look at Blank Street, for example, which the matcha based coffee shop, it's the interesting flavor profiles that they are able to market based on a color, really, because people don't want to taste matcha or the generation don't. I love it, but they don't necessarily want to taste the matcha. But by God, they want to taste a brown sugar burnt caramelized chocolate brownie, which is stuffed into the matcha as well.
So, following on, Alexandra.
Yes. So, I just wanted to tap in as from the researcher perspective on the social media research, right? Like, I bet everyone who is in the food industry must have looked into the social media as a source of the inspiration, trends. Because I think it's just opened a totally new chapter in terms of the research, in terms of the reaching out to the consumers in their natural habitat, understanding very quickly and efficiently what's going on, how they comment around the flavors or the textures, the visual outlook, etc. So I just wanted to say that it's really great tool. I think it has to be also used smartly with not to avoid bias, because it has advantages, disadvantages. You most likely get the great insights around, you know, Gen Z, younger generations, because not everyone posts there, right? So thinking about younger generations, this is a great tool to spot the first viral trends.
Mm-hmm. Totally, but it's also about where it's going to land. You know, because not every flavor and every color works in every single category. Yeah. You know, people automatically think just because something is big that it's gonna land everywhere, and it absolutely doesn't. You know, people are probably not gonna eat a match of popcorn.
Well, that was my follow up. What you're saying is you're talking about sweet category, especially where you are in the social media side, because we're in the key trends kind of space. You talked about global flavors. We're also seeing that being such a strong trend that we see everywhere. Again, driven by the social media side of it, but because people are just so open to different parts of the world now. So travel is still one of those big occasions. And for everyone, and when I said before, I said everybody likes to travel and we get that food. When you talked about the carrier being matcha or ube or whatever it is now, we're seeing the same thing in the snacks industry. Chicken is like, I think it was the CEO of KFC. I was watching him on a talk the other day. And he was saying that chicken's just booming again. And the reason being that is it's a carrier for that global flavors. It's the safe space for consumers, especially within the UK, to go, I understand chicken. It's a good carrier, but I can mix it with Korean, or I can mix it with Japanese, or I can mix it with Indian. And so it's such a safe spot for them to be able to understand and resonate with a flavor, but then be a little bit more adventurous with that global flavor. And that, and how we talked about, and you talked about the trends, you know, curve going up and where it's coming through. Especially when we, you know, where do we land on that curve now? So beforehand, it would be we'd wait until it was mainstream. And then we'd land on it and we'd bring the flavor out now. But maybe we don't anymore. Maybe we look at what's emerging and we start launching that and trying through there, because is going to mainstream when you're up at the safe or on the decline too late for us, especially with it? That's our way ups all the time now within the company, is where on that curve do we land? And if we're too early, it can go wrong. And if we're too late, it can go wrong. So it's really identifying that. But yeah, like, global flavors is one of the big spaces that,
yeah,
definitely.
What do you think is the next global flavor? Because I know we know the Far East is the big one at the moment. Where's the next one? Where are we looking to next?
I mean, I've got a personal opinion on this. It's got to be that K-pop Korean space. Like, it's emerging even in the UK now. So, like, I guess we're all in the food industry. So we're on the emergent, probably start end of the trends. So when we go into London or whatever and go to the markets and we'll see what's there. Whereas the consumers in the UK are usually a little bit further behind that, your day-to-day consumers. So I think that Korean K-pop style is probably on that to come into mainstream, coming out the end of emerging. I think we've got to be there.
As we can see, Ross is taking full advantage of picking the other panelists' brains, and all for the delight of our audience. Thank you, Ross. I'd like to maybe put a spotlight on our next speaker, who's maybe feeling like everyone else needs to shut up a bit.
Sorry, Ross.
Robert Craggs, can you tell me how all of these different pieces of information — we're talking about social media, we're talking about all of these different pieces of information coming together — how do you balance that kind of complexity in an actual food design? At the end of the day, we have to deliver something to consumers, right? So all of these different things that we take, all of these little pieces of information from all over the shop, eventually has to come down to the nuts and bolts of the matter. Can you speak about that a bit?
Yeah, so when you think about what we've heard from the panel today, we've got the data, we've got the flavor house knowledge sharing, we've got other experts, other producers in the industry sharing new innovations constantly, etc. So first of all, what you do is you'd work out, where do you want to be, right? But first of all, is what is all that information telling us? Where do we want to be? And then from a culinary perspective, the first thing that I would do and we would do is we'd anchor that back into the correct cuisine. So the flavor territories we talk about. If we're talking about citrus, obviously then it's back into the varietal types or the fruits. If we're talking about Korean, it's then back to the authentic dishes of the region. So first of all, what I would do is get right under the skin of what's true. And the best way to do that is often to go to source as well. Go to Korea, go to where we grow the citrus, understand what's going on with these flavors and what key properties we all have, whether it's the aromas, the growing variety, etc. Understand it really innately, understand how consumers are using it within these territories as well. Get close to it. Doesn't matter where you are in any market, get as close to it as you can. And it goes back to that. Once you get close to it, you start to then understand that emotional resonance that we spoke about earlier. That is the absolute key thing. What is the emotional resonance? And I think understanding, doesn't matter what we think that flavor is, it's about what does the audience where your product is going to land think that flavor is, what emotionally resonates with them. From there, you get back into the kitchen and you start to build as close as you can to the dish or the creation. Remember, we all create foodstuffs, whether that be fresh food, ready meal solutions, ISB solutions, or we work in the snacking industry. It all actually starts with a plate of food in the beginning. And then build that plate with that knowledge. Taste it, experience it, understand the textures, the aromas, the visuals. All these things play part. Understand how all the basics of flavor start to play a part, whether it be acid, whether it be fatty, creamy, sweet, all these things.
Do you think that's...
And then understand ultimately from there, if you're certainly in the snacking industry, you know, what is your base layer? What's your middle layer? What's your top notes? And then work with these experts, the flavor houses, etc., to try and build that flavor, map that flavor, map that experience. But it goes back to that occasion piece again. Mm. Understand what you want your flavor in your brand to do. What is the flavor strategy within that brand? And how do you then drive that forward with, I suppose, all those building blocks?
Yeah, and then I guess measure, right?
Yeah,
and then
of course.
You have to measure. At the end of the day, is this making you cash? If it's not, stop doing it. Right? Or do people like it? It's basically what I'm saying. I wonder how the influence of, is it grammable? Like the effect of like food needs to look good. And I know from the recent past, a ready meal doesn't look amazing, right? Some of them don't look that great. You wouldn't want to say, oh, I'm eating in tonight, I've got a ready meal, and put that on Instagram. People will be like, dude, you need to get out more, right? What is the role of this, the visual aspect, and how does that play into color?
I think for me, color, you've got to look at it from a globalized perspective as well. We're really fortunate in this region, right? We associate all the flavors and colors we work with. We're very natural, but that's not the same all around the world. So you've got to start to then understand that nuance about what's important about color, where and why. But for me, I drag it back to the cuisine and back to the region. Where your product is going to land if it's in the UK? What is the acceptable color for? Let's just say, I don't know, a burnt lemon bash cheesecake, for example. So understand what the market tells you what's acceptable. Understand what your brand is trying to do, say, with our flavor, and then position it accordingly as well. So it is. There's a lot of looking outside first and then decide inside about where do you want it to be, how do you want it to be perceived, and what's really, really important. And it's not back to, should we say, the creator's sole opinion. It's back to what will fit and resonate with the consumer and how do you position it and how do you differentiate it from what else is in that marketplace.
Yeah, exactly. And I think by some unbelievable stroke of genius, all of these things are leading towards how do we measure uncertainty, and how do we measure uncertainty in innovation, especially with regards to flavor and color. And well, I guess other people in the past have called me an expert in that. So find me later. I'm kidding, but do try find me. I think people had some follow-ups on these questions. Ross, you've got a follow-up, and then maybe we've got some time to get some questions from the audience.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting what you were saying about the perception, what their perception is of color based on food. I think, you know, if you go back to when, say, food television first started, and you had the likes of, I don't know if anyone's ever heard of Fanny Craddock, but you know, you looked at the food that she would have created on television. And it was gray. It was all people had ever seen. It was kind of that was their relationship to the newness of food. And if you look at how that worked its way through television through the years up to Nigella and what we've now got on Instagram, it's kind of like Technicolor. It's gone through the whole Wizard of Oz thing, where it's gone from being black and white all the way through to this vibrancy. And I think the assumption is that that's what people think they're going to eat nowadays. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about you know, what people see in the packet versus what their actual expectations. Their expectations are so high. They're waiting for that multi-sensory experience where you know, you hear that expression, taste the rainbow. You know, what does the rainbow taste like?
I fully support that. I think that it's another element that is now becoming available because we have more widespread availability of ingredients from different places around the world, which is both a double-edged sword, right? So it's like, yes, we need to start thinking about food miles, where things come from. But before we were talking about GLP-1 and AI, this, AI, that, we were talking about globalization. We were talking about these cross-cultural shifts. And there's a reason teriyaki chicken is now on a crisp, right? And the people that it's expected for people to like it. We're sharing things cross-culturally, and it's kind of like a safer way to drive innovation, because you know that these things are accepted and appealing in a different culture. So I think that's really great. And thinking about then how do we enhance all aspects of the food, not just what it tastes like when you eat it, actually the before, the after, the during, and thinking about that consumption maybe at the moment and really targeting, focusing on the specific targets. I would like to open the floor for questions. And if you have a question, raise your hand. Please direct a question at who you'd like to ask it to. And we'll go quickly. Alexandra, Regina, Ross.
Robert,
Mike.
My question is for Regina, maybe Alexandra as well. In the CSD space, what do you think, is there power behind being divisive? Kind of going to that question of like not appeasing everyone, let's say being a really spicy drink or really sour or something else.
Do you want to start?
Normally, I'm looking for culinary category. Just don't get me wrong. So maybe beverages is not my area of expertise. But what I see happening on the market and what I can see from as insights from our research, CSD and beverage category is the category that has I think it's a very wide and like have lots of opportunity in terms of the where you want, how you look at the things. So it's very innovative. I think the most innovative out of what our colleagues, researchers are looking at. So I think the there is for sure lots of room to go different routes, and that you may find the audience looking at the, you know, functional drinks with the adaptogens and nootropics, or looking at the CSD drinks, which is just maybe no low alcohol that are for the different type of occasions. So it's like a very, very creative space.
So adding on specifically to your question, having been a beverage flavorist, 100% yes. Be out there, make a splash, right? I think that's important. But it's really, really important to measure from the outset, what is your available market? What are you expecting, right? So think about what the target is and then base your innovation on that. So don't pile in millions and millions of pounds into something that the market potential is smaller than, right? So I feel like it's good to make a splash. And as we've seen from other examples, sometimes being this Marmite kind of product can be a good thing, because any publicity is good publicity and gets people talking about it. And then you're kind of piggybacking on the social media train, right? Yeah. So I think for sure there's something to be gained by doing it. It's just about measuring what is your available market and what is the juice worth the squeeze, right?
Yeah, so I agree with you 100%. CSD is probably leading flavor innovations across many, and they are the first to adopt because there is so much room for that. The suggestions that you mentioned, I wouldn't call them divisive because there is so much room. And as Trevor said, depends whom you are targeting these drinks for. There is a potential to go big with them. Also, as Alexandra said, there is a very big market for adult-oriented soft drinks that are alcohol alternatives. More consumers drink less, they cut, they become teetotal, and they don't want to go to a pub and have Fanta or have something that...
Other brands are available.
Sorry. They just don't want a generic soft drink that perhaps our children drink, right, on occasion. They want something that's perhaps less sweet,
yeah,
that is more sophisticated, that brings them joy, that, and they don't feel that they are compromising. So potential is quite a space.
And I think coming from a non-drinks market, yeah, you know, we look to the drinks market. So, you know, if I'm looking for something really exciting, the first place I will go to
drinks
is the drinks section, or go to a new cafe, coffee shop, especially the kind of like the Japanese dessert bars, you know, what they've got going on in things like coolers and spritzes. It's definitely the globalization. Like people are willing to risk that money on that little bit, something interesting, because it's a gift from me to me. And that's when I think the trends kind of explode.
Yeah. And I do agree, food service often leads the trends, because bubble tea, mm-hmm, that took off in food service, now we have kits and ready-made bubble tea drinks in retail as well.
Yeah, that stretching the drinks market is really, really important. It gives us right to play. And that's, you know, in, across category, like we're talking about, whether it be cakes, snacks, etc., biscuits, it gives you the right to play. And I think it's really, really helpful. And I suppose it's really relatable. And it's a really accessible point for consumers as well to often get into. That's relatively lower risk. And I think, it's a useful space.
At the risk of no longer being relevant, Mike, you had a question about a half an hour ago.
Mentioned there's a really good book called like Zero to One that if people have heard of or whatever it is, and it's about growing brands, businesses, so on and so forth. And in there, one of the key topics that you talked about is like, if you are, is it going to be too spicy, is it going to be whatever, if you're not doing something that's taken a step change towards where you're going, it's going to fail. So if you're trying, and again, that's why my belief in there, if you're trying to appease everybody, you'll appease no one comes from. So if you understand your consumer and your consumer likes heat, go for heat, because they'll only be disappointed if they don't get it.
And I think that's actually the book is really, that book is amazing. It's Zero to One. And what it discusses is you have incremental innovation and you also have transformational or evolutionary innovation, which is like change the script, change the rule book, rip it up, start again. And sometimes when we're trying to reduce risk, we kind of stay in our lanes and we maybe merge just to tangential things. There is definitely scope to try something new, but don't pump everything into it, right? So I think that also great book. Guys, we've come to the end of our session. My impeccably knowledgeable experts and the leaders in the future of food.
Thank you for listening to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If this has whet your appetite for next year's Food Matters live events, you can already register your interest to partner with us in London and Rotterdam. Just head to foodmatterslive.com.